It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Sunday, December 11th, 2022. I'm Jared Halpern. Democrats pick up the last Senate seat up for grabs in 2022.
I mean, look, I think Georgia is a toss-up at the presidential level now.
I'm Jessica Rosenthal. After the collapse of a mega crypto exchange, there's renewed interest in regulating the crypto market. And two senators, one Democrat, one Republican, say their bill is ready to go in the next Congress.
Had FTX been organized under the laws of the United States, including the Financial Innovation Act, it would not have happened.
This is the Fox News Rundown from Washington. A beaming Senator Chuck Schumer held court for the press corps this week, at one point holding up both hands, his right showing all 5 fingers, his left just one, to signify the 51 Democratic seats he'll have in the new Congress.
After 1 year, 10 months, and 17 days of the longest 50-50 Senate in history, 51, yeah. A slim majority. That is great. And we are so happy about it.
Schumer, the majority leader, was, of course, reacting to Tuesday night's victory by Senator Raphael Warnock in Georgia, the final contest of the 2022 midterms, sealing the outright majority for Democrats. Of course, some of that excitement has now tempered because early Friday, Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema announced she is leaving the Democratic Party and will register as an independent in her home state. That by itself won't change the Senate makeup. Sinema does not intend, she says, to caucus with Republicans and expects to keep her committee assignments through the Democrats. In other words, it appears she'll simply be the third independent who counts towards the Democrats' majority, like Vermont's Bernie Sanders and Maine's Angus King. So the effect could be more political than practical. It does, of course, reinforce just how important that Georgia race was and why 51 is so much better than 50 for Schumer and the Democrats. So let's talk about that expanded Senate majority and how Warnock beat Republican challenger Herschel Walker in a state otherwise dominated by Republicans this year. Kyle Condick is the managing editor of Sabato's Crystal Ball at the University of Virginia's Center for Politics.
I think that the Georgia results fit in with sort of a broader story this election cycle, which was that, you know, really from a turnout perspective, it seems like Republicans kind of got what they wanted in terms of, you know, who was showing up. It's just that I think they failed from a persuasion standpoint in a lot of these key races. And it didn't cost them the House, but it probably cost them the Senate. In that, you know, I think you can imagine a world in which there's maybe a stronger Republican candidate in Georgia or maybe a few other states that maybe would have allowed the Republicans to win the Senate. And, you know, they just failed to do so. You know, the Republicans just didn't do quite as well with independents, I think, as, you know, the opposition party often does in a midterm. And, you know, I think they also probably bled some small but significant amount of Republican support. And, you know, you look at the results in, like, Metro Atlanta or in some other states like Metro Phoenix, you know, those places that used to be a lot friendlier to Republicans than they are now. And you know, you could point to problems on both sides. I mean, we're in a very competitive era in American politics, and you got two parties that are pretty evenly matched a lot of the time. But, you know, when you look ahead to 2024, Republicans just need to do better in some of these big suburban areas if they're going to be winning some of these key states in electoral college, be it in Arizona or Georgia or Pennsylvania, et cetera.
I mean, I think that's what's fascinating as we look at this Georgia race, because I think it would be easy to kind of like now put Georgia in this toss-up category. Biden narrowly won there. Now they have two senators who are Democrats. But the results would indicate that Republicans outperformed Democrats almost across the board, for the exception of the Warnock-Walker race. What category do you put Georgia into?
I mean, look, I think Georgia is a toss-up at the presidential level now, and I think that a stronger Republican candidate than Donald Trump or Herschel Walker is probably a favorite in a state like Georgia, given how well the Republicans did in the other statewide elections.
Say Brian Kemp won by a pretty healthy margin. Up and down the ballot, Republicans did well.
Yeah, Brad Raffensperger, drew the ire of Donald Trump, and so did Brian Kemp, they both did great. I mean, Raffensperger did even a little bit better in terms of margin than Kemp did. He was just shy of winning by about 10 points. I do think there's an opportunity maybe for both parties to sort of look at what happened in 2020 and 2022 and think that, Biden has some weaknesses, the sitting president. Donald Trump has some weaknesses as the most recent former president and as an announced candidate for 2024. If there's an opportunity maybe for either party to sort of break out of the current mold and produce maybe a fresher candidate, might be something that the electorate might welcome, given that both Biden and Trump have pretty poor overall kind of approval / favorability nationally. But the question is, can either party do that? At this point, Biden certainly looks like the favorite to be the Democratic nominee if he wants to be. And, you get different polls tell different stories about Trump and Ron DeSantis is his main challenger. Some have DeSantis up, some have Trump up. But, I do think Trump still has some advantages in terms of the nomination process.
I mean, and right now, a lot of those polls are sort of in the abstract, right? Because there aren't declared candidates outside of the former president.
That's right. Yeah. You got a long way to go until the delegate selection plans are finalized. Of course, the Democrats are fiddling with their calendar. But the Republican side, we did see this in 2016, that if it's a big field, the plurality winners end up being advantaged. That helped Trump in like some of the early states like New Hampshire and South Carolina and Nevada, where he wasn't getting a majority of the vote necessarily. Particularly New Hampshire and South Carolina, but he was getting the lion's share of the delegates. And so, big crowded field could actually, benefit Trump potentially.
Let me ask this about Georgia as we kind of look at the results. Was this election, the Senate runoff, and I guess the general election as well, about policies or was it about personalities? And what does that tell us about how parties have to compete in places like Georgia?
That's a great question. I think that I probably would edge more toward the personality side, but I also think that there are legitimate kind of policy questions that are wrapped up in that. I think that Republicans sort of allow themselves to get painted as extreme on certain things, be it support of the former president or issues like abortion, which, of course, became really important based on the Supreme Court decision. I don't think it was really an election that was a whole lot about like bread and butter, tax and spend kind of issues. I think it was more about whether Democrats were able to make this election more of a choice in certain places or whether it was more of a referendum. In the places where it was more of a choice, I think Democrats did better. And I would say that at least in the Georgia Senate race, it was more of a choice than a referendum. You could say that in the other Georgia statewide races, it was a positive referendum on Republican leadership of that particular state, given how well Brian Kemp did and some of the other Republican statewides. But in the Senate race, it became more of a choice. And, Raphael Warnock just had a lot better favorability than Herschel Walker did. Certainly, there were a lot of people who had an unfavorable view of Walker who voted for him anyway, but it just wasn't enough.
And in a race like that, you need turnout more than anything else. I mean, what I mean by that, as you've looked at the numbers, was there a deficiency in sort of dedicated Republican voters showing up for Herschel Walker?
I don't know I think if Walker had been a more appealing candidate, the turnout would have been just fine for him. I think there was more of a persuasion problem. Mm-hmm. Look, there are differences between, there obviously is a drop off between the first round and the second round of voting. Warnock did do better in his second round of voting than in the first round of voting. But my understanding of it, just based on what I've sort of seen and read about it, is that, it wasn't necessarily that, I think in 2021, it seemed like Democrats maybe sort of turned it out better than Republicans did in Georgia, and that there was less drop off from the regular election of the runoff in 2020 and 2021. This time I'm not so sure about that. I think the turnout mix was okay for Republicans. It's just that they had some persuasion problems again, particularly in Metro Atlanta, but some other parts of the state too.
Does having 51 senators now for Democrats change in your view sort of how they go about the next year, 2 years here heading into the next election?
just from a logistical standpoint, it is helpful for Democrats to have an actual majority. They have they'll have majorities on the committees now. They don't have to do some sort of power sharing agreement like was in place in the current Senate. Modern Senate majorities, if they share the party of the president, they often act as sort of a judicial confirmation factories.
Right.
And
yeah.
For some arcane logistical reasons, it's just easier to get nominees confirmed when you got 51 as opposed to 50, and it's a tied Senate with a vice presidential tiebreaker. So I suspect we'll see Democrats try to squeeze as many judges as they can out of the next 2 years, and there also are investigative avenues that open up for the Senate that didn't exist prior, given with subpoena power and other things, by having a real majority. So maybe some of the investigative work that was happening in the House won't be happening now because of the Republican majorities, and Republicans will be focusing on other things. But maybe there are things that the Senate Democrats can do from an investigative standpoint or an oversight standpoint that they weren't able to do in the current Senate.
So that's an interesting thought, that the Democrat-controlled Senate could pick up some of these investigations that the House Democrats have been working on for the last 2 years.
Yeah, I was thinking specifically about January 6th, although...
Yeah.
I don't know the logistics of that. As we're talking here, I was just sort of brainstorming about it.
Yeah.
So I don't necessarily know, but of course that committee's work is going to be wrapped up because the Republicans are going to continue that in the House at least, but maybe some of that flows over to the Senate. I don't know.
It's an interesting thought. I guess I'll end with this, and that is, does this, in your view, change the likelihood of sort of major legislative accomplishments? I know that, we've heard from Mitch McConnell, who's talked about, you have to govern from the 40-yard lines, and he and President Biden have talked a lot about, say, like the infrastructure bill and the CHIPS bill. I mean, that's where the governing is going to have to be done, right? It's not as if either side's going to get their tax policies or their immigration policies or their gun policies in a divided Congress like this.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think the big question of the first 2 years of the Biden administration was, what could Democrats squeeze out of a 50-50 Senate and a narrow House majority? This time the House is going to be passing things that the Senate Democrats aren't going to support. And, the Senate is potentially going to pass things that the House isn't going to go along with. So, you do have to compromise more, although it may just lead to more gridlock. You do also have this sort of looming problem of the debt ceiling, and could you see some sort of default if Republicans essentially want to force concessions that the Democrats won't give into, as opposed to just sort of passing kind of a clean debt ceiling increase? So, those are things that are kind of looming out there. Of course, we have seen those sorts of battles happen in divided government. 2011, there was a big debt ceiling fight.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we'll see another one in 2023. And, just for, the stability of the country, I do wonder if, you'll just see won't be much agreement on things. And again, there is the possibility of a default, which I think at least for the business community, people who follow this stuff closely, that's a looming threat that I think is pretty scary.
You mentioned that 2011 agreement that was negotiated by a couple of guys named Biden and McConnell. So we'll see if they.
That is true. I mean, they do still, McConnell is, the Senate is still closely divided, of course. And
yeah.
And so, the Senate minority just always has more power.
The thing's 60 votes. Yeah. So, yeah, you're right.
Right. And, it does. You do also have to look ahead to 2024. It's a really difficult Senate map for Democrats. They were able to squeeze an extra seat out of this election, gives them more of a fighting chance for 2024. But, the Republicans, I think it's fair to say, fumbled away the ability to win the Senate this cycle. But they've got another golden opportunity coming up in 2024, probably a more attractive opportunity in 24 than in 22. So
sure,
I think Republicans need to get their act together on the candidate selection front. But again, they do have some opportunities this time in 24.
We know that map is always shifting, so we'll continue to have these conversations to sort of understand it as it shifts in front of our feet. Kyle Condit, appreciate the time as always. Happy end of the midterm season to you, my friend.
Yeah, absolutely. Happy holidays.
Pull up a chair and join me, Rachel Campos Duffy.
And me, former U.S. Congressman Sean Duffy, as we share our perspective on the discussions happening at kitchen tables across America.
Download From the Kitchen Table, The Duffys, at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons FTX, one of the largest crypto companies, collapsed is arguably because there were no real regulations in place. It was the subject of a recent Senate Agriculture Committee hearing as ag regulates commodities. And so the head of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, Rostin Benham, told senators he has no direct authority to regulate cash digital commodity markets.
We simply do not have authority to register cash market exchanges or any intermediary broker dealer or entity within that structure. And that's what concerns me, right? This is the gap. If we don't do something, customers are going to continue to lose money and we're going to be right back here again in a couple months.
He said there should be shared responsibility on this between the CFTC and the SEC, but that without new authority, there'd be another FTX-style collapse soon. The Treasury Secretary recently called the FTX collapse a Lehman moment, a reference to the 2008 financial crisis, and JP Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon told Squawk Box on CNBC he thinks she meant it's a Lehman moment in crypto.
There's 20 to 30 billion of ransomware a year that we know about, 20 to 30 billion of exchange costs that we know about, lots of AML, anti-terrorism financing, tax avoidance, right. Sex trafficking. Why do we allow this stuff to take place?
As for the head of FTX, it remains to be seen what sort of consequences Sam Bankman-Fried will face in the absence of regulations. He said in an interview last week on ABC's Good Morning America,
I did not know that there is any improper use of customer funds. I really deeply wish that I had taken, a lot more responsibility for understanding what the details were of what was going on there.
He said he hadn't been spending any of his time managing risks. So the question is, with the proposed legislation in the Senate addressing crypto regulation, if it had been in place earlier, could it have prevented the collapse of FTX?
Had FTX been organized under the laws of the United States?
Cynthia Lummis is a Republican senator from Wyoming and a Bitcoin owner. She's working on legislation with New York Democratic Senator Kirsten Gillibrand.
Including the Financial Innovation Act, it would not have happened. They would not have been allowed to rehypothecate, which means loaning the same money over and over. The number of organizations that they were trying to bundle to provide multiple investment type services to clients would not be allowed. Those two things alone could have prevented an FTX bankruptcy.
My understanding is, and I'm no expert on the crypto space, but a huge aspect of the fallout here was where was the regulation, right? It turns out there are not generally many rules in the crypto space. Does that mean that Sam Bankman-Fried and others at FTX may not face any real consequences here if there were no rules to break?
There will be consequences because the rules against fraud still apply to FTX just the same as they would to any other company engaging in fraudulent transactions. So I do believe there will be major consequences for the principals at FTX.
Now, Bankman-Fried said in recent interviews this wasn't a Ponzi scheme and it wasn't fraud, he said, but that he made mistakes. He didn't pay enough attention to risk management. The accusations, as far as I can tell, are that he created this token. And while FTX was a crypto exchange, he also owned Alameda Research, which was trading on his own FTX platform. I know there's a Wall Street Journal piece out that sort of hypothesized that customer funds may have been mixed, the possibility that people could have been trading on margin, essentially not having the funds to cover the bets they wanted to place. What are you, as somebody who is very knowledgeable about this space, what is your knowledge about what may have happened here?
Well, FTX created a token called FTT. They sent some of it over to Alameda. They propped up and basically invented the value of FTT. Mm-hmm. Then they sold a puffed up value to outside investors. They used outside investor funds to lobby and to prop up their equity agenda. So they looked like a very woke philanthropic organization in their ultimate goals. In doing so, they pulled the wool under the eye of some of the more woke-oriented investors. And then they pulled their money from under Alameda. And when they did, of course, FTT collapsed because it really had no value outside of the value that they had created through their own hype. So these are fraudulent activities. This is not just inadvertence. They had no board of directors. They had no financial management. They had 135 different organizations that were used to obfuscate what they were doing. It was clearly fraud.
He was supposed to testify, or there was some talk that December 13th was the day that there would be a hearing on this, and he, I guess, either tweeted or wrote on social media that he wasn't ready to. What's your understanding of when you all might hear from the man himself?
Well, if I was his lawyer, I would strongly recommend that he not testify. If he has legal advice, I don't expect to hear from him. And if he doesn't, he has a fool for a client.
let's pivot to talk about specifically your bill. I understand you and Kirsten Gillibrand introduced legislation this year, and I just want you to set it up for us, because I understand you own Bitcoin. You're very educated about the crypto space. So walk us through this. There's crypto like Bitcoin that is mined. There are things that are tokens that someone like a Sam Bankman-Fried can invent. And I'm curious about what kind of backing tokens like that have, given their value or what their perceived value is. And then we have, of course, derivatives, right? Crypto futures or options. When it comes to regulating all of this, essentially, what does this boil down to? We're trying to figure out if they're securities or commodities?
And other things. So there are two goals. We are trying to lay the digital asset class on top of our existing financial regulatory framework. So just as today there are commodities and securities, there will be a definition, in fact, the same definition that's used for commodities and securities today. It's called the Howey test, to determine which of these tokens are commodities and which are securities. Now, I would suggest that currently only one digital asset falls into the category of a commodity. It is Bitcoin. Bitcoin is completely decentralized, totally trustless. Its value is based on its scarcity, and it's permissionless, meaning you don't need permission from anyone to buy and sell or mine. I think just about everything else right now is a security. When Ethereum moved from being more like traditional mining of Bitcoin into something called proof of stake, that means other stakeholders, other owners of Ethereum, will be the ones who determine and validate whether a new Ethereum has been created. So that's a system that relies on other people, current owners, to determine its validity and its value. That sounds a lot more like a security to me.
It sounds like, just to clarify for our listeners, the difference is something that is perceived to have an objective value versus a subjective value.
You know, I think that's a pretty good characterization of it. And then we will have the securities regulated by the SEC. They have very strong consumer protection and disclosure requirements. And then Bitcoin will be over at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission.
Does your bill, though, say that most of this crypto space would be regulated by the CFTC, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission? And if so, then why would we, who's going to regulate and work on all the other crypto assets if they're classified as securities? Is that the SEC?
Yes, it is the SEC. So the vast majority of cryptocurrencies will be regulated by the SEC.
Do you have any concerns about that, given what happened with FTX and what's happened thus far? Like, do you feel like the SEC is up to the task?
The SEC will probably need additional staffing because there are so many cryptocurrencies. So I think we are going to have to beef up their team just in terms of the sheer numbers, because there are so many cryptocurrencies.
For those of us who haven't like been in this space and aren't as knowledgeable as you, you know, we look at crypto, specifically Bitcoin, because that's what a lot of the financial shows show us. And we've seen these sort of wild fluctuations. Even if there's a difference between Bitcoin and its proof of work, or it, you know, how it's different from other cryptos, what does that mean about how things are backed? Because my understanding is a lot of the fluctuation or the skepticism of crypto is, what is this thing's value? Who is determining this thing's value? You've just said to me that Bitcoin has a different sort of calculation in terms of how we value it versus all of these other cryptos. So does your bill sort of address that, or say, or give some guidance on how we place a value on one of these tokens?
Well, these tokens are valued by the market, by supply and demand. The fact that there will only be 21 million Bitcoin ever mined, and that fractions of Bitcoin are mined every 10 minutes, and that the algorithm, the math that it takes to produce them, gets more complicated as time goes on, is sort of the underlying tenets behind its value. Its value is based on scarcity. The other types of cryptocurrencies that don't have anything near the fundamentals that Bitcoin does are more speculative with regard to their value. So I know it's been somewhat interesting to a lot of us that even during these financial crises in the digital asset industry, that Bitcoin has gone down right along with other cryptocurrencies. Part of the reason is that people trade among cryptocurrencies. They will trade Bitcoin for Ethereum, Cardano, Solana, Dogecoins. And so they're diluting or making each other's value more speculative when you do that kind of interaction among coins. But if you look at Bitcoin as a standalone, it really is pretty much digital gold because of its scarcity. Its value will likely recover. Some of the other cryptocurrencies are going to fail.
Just a couple more for you. So furthermore, with your legislation, it sounds like this bill is going to classify, you know, what crypto assets are and aren't, put them under existing regulatory bodies like either the CFTC or the SEC. And then what? Does the legislation then further say how this is to be regulated, or what specifically these federal agencies are to do now in this space?
Well, basically, they'll do the same things that they do now for other types of commodities, in case of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. So they'll have the futures and the spot market over at CFTC in Bitcoin. And then the types of consumer protections and disclosures that are typically filed at the SEC by existing securities will be used to make sure that disclosure and consumer protection requirements currently existing for other types of assets are applied to digital assets as well. Then our bill deals also with stablecoins, which is a different type of financial instrument. A stablecoin is essentially backed by U.S. dollars or another government's currency, typically called fiat currencies. Mm-hmm. So our bill would require that stable coins would be 100% backed by hard assets, and that they would not be allowed to fall below 100% full backing. So you can get your money out of a stable coin at a moment's notice. And then right now our bill restricts it to banks as issuers of stable coins, since it's backed by US dollars. Senator Toomey has a bill right now that would allow for commercial companies to create stable coins as long as they're 100% asset backed. We're trying to see if there's a way that we can meld those bills, but I don't expect to see us pass anything before the new Congress in 2023.
Sure. Yeah, my next question actually was going to be about stablecoins, but in the interest of time, I just sort of want your, a summation of your thoughts, because, you know, people are nervous about the space. They want to get in it. It's very hyped, as you said. And it sounds like you're hoping to provide some stability to all of this. I just wonder about the sort of broader international discussion, you know, about China coming up with its own digital currency. I know this past summer, Neel Kashkari, the Federal Reserve Bank president in Minnesota, sort of mocked this idea. And he was like, why would Americans want a central bank digital currency? You know, having their transactions tracked, you know, what does this solve for when I can just Venmo you $8 right now? What are your sort of broad overall thoughts about, I guess, either a central bank digital backed currency or just this space generally and us playing in it and being in it?
Well, I too oppose a central bank digital currency that is direct to retail. The digital yuan in China is used by China and the Chinese Communist Party as a means of surveillance. That should never be allowed in the United States. So I'm opposed to a CDBC that is direct to retail. It's okay with me if the central banks themselves, the Fed, their participating banks, and other central banks around the world have a CDBC that they can use to transact among themselves to settle accounts faster and cheaper around the world. But I don't want a digital dollar, a CDBC, to be direct to consumers. So I agree with that. And ultimately, the goal here is to regulate an asset class that right now is unregulated. I don't want to ban it. I want it to continue to innovate and grow in the United States, but I want to do it in a way that assures consumers that consumer protections are going to be available to them and that they can use to educate themselves about whether they, as an investor, are willing to take the risks associated with investing in certain cryptocurrencies or certain, for example, IRAs that include digital assets. You know, I myself am comfortable with Bitcoin and nothing else right now, but we might get to the point where some of the innovations that can occur, for example, on top of the Ethereum protocol, could allow for a whole new opportunity to put smart contracts on a digital ledger. And so we don't want to stifle that kind of innovation. That's why we want to make sure that there is adequate consumer disclosure and consumer protections, but that these companies and businesses are allowed to exist and innovate in the United States pursuant to a well-understood regulatory framework. So Senator Gillibrand's bill and my bill are to create that regulatory framework.
Senator Lemus of Wyoming, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Looking ahead to this week, we're following debate over the debt ceiling as lawmakers in Congress hope to avoid a government shutdown, as well as the National Defense Authorization Act. It's been passed by the House. Now it's up to the Senate. Until then, I'm Jessica Rosenthal. Thanks for listening to the Fox News Rundown from Washington.
Stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Kilmeade. I want you to join me weekdays at 9 a.m. East as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and, of course, what you think.
Listen live or get the podcast now at BrianKilmeadeShow.com.